You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
The Anatomists, In Defiance of Man and God, by Laura Mazur.
I am a surgeon turned educator. After spending the last decade as a general surgeon and a surgical educator in medical schools and simulation labs, I made the move recently to secondary education, and now I help build Montessori high schools. It is an unusual move. And so I frequently find myself explaining why here and why now. Why here and why now? And that might be a question you would ask before coming into this session, although I am glad you're here. But why here and why now? Why a talk today at this conference on the history of anatomy? And the simple answer is, there's a story I want the opportunity to tell. Anatomy is a topic that has fascinated me since medical school. In the first semester of medical school, we all spend hours in a dissecting lab, piecing apart a cadaver and studying the nerves, arteries, veins, organs, and bones that make up a human being. And it's an incredible experience, one that results in a mix of different emotions. Awe for the beauty and complexity of the human form, grief for a person who has passed, sometimes even disgust or distaste for a process that feels very strange, and gratitude for the chance to learn firsthand the secrets of our physical form. And we learn as we complete our own dissection that this opportunity to study is hard fought, as with so many things. On the wall of my medical school's anatomy lab is a photo from the 1700s, supposedly showing two physicians transporting a cadaver that they had stolen from a graveyard in the dead of night. This is the checkered past of the anatomy lab, a history of grave robbing and of heresy, a story of sacrilege and hubris. But at its root, it's a story of heroism, and that's what has always drawn me to anatomy and what I hope to share today. The story I'm about to tell you is a love story for observation and for explanation and the way the first is the fundamental source of the second. The story centers on the tale of a particularly challenging and practically difficult type of observation and the inferences it makes possible. This is a story wrapped up in our deepest beliefs about who we are as human beings. One where faith, culture, law, and instinct clash, sometimes violently. This is a story about how the simple act of observing the world and of connecting the dots therefrom requires moral courage and extreme independence. While my personal love of anatomy fuels my interest in this story, I would also argue that there is something fundamental about the field. When considering the history of medicine, of the science of medicine, you might be tempted to begin with what today is called pharmacology, the impact of substances on the human body. And it was probably prehistoric man who first was able to recognize the impact of herbs and leaves on health. The recognition that eating the red berries caused you to die a painful death or have a lot of diarrhea. The idea that boiling the bark of a certain tree could cure a headache. But I would argue that the true science of medicine has to begin with anatomy, and that it is to anatomy that we must pay first homage for all of the advancements we enjoy today. There were centuries of observations prior to anatomy, the relationship between something in the world and something in the body. Eating a specific type of leaf and getting sick or getting well, forgetting to pray to the sun god and having your hunt fail. A careful attention to these correlations can influence your behavior as a person. But none of these observations carried with it an understanding of how or why. If science is about understanding the causes of things, then medicine became a science through anatomy. To understand causes in a medical context requires an understanding of the human body. An understanding of how it works, yes, but anatomy is even more fundamental than that. Anatomy is the very, very basic question of what is, what the body looks like, what are its parts. And that has not been an easy question to answer for most of history. And it's not a question that can be answered simply by observing human behavior in action. It's not obvious or easy to know what makes up a person by seeing the hair, skin, teeth, and nails that are perceptible to the naked eye. To understand human function and form, we need to actually look inside. And looking inside means opening up the human body, peeling back protective layers of skin and of muscle, and exploring with an inquiring mind. The cause of human health and of sickness are discovered through study of the inner workings of the human body. But however necessary and valuable it is to open up a body, for most of history, we've been somewhat understandably horrified by the prospect. We've viewed it as an affront to our very humanity, as distasteful and lowly and morally suspect. In many societies, it's seen as a danger to the immortal soul, and so we outlaw it. Indeed, explanation of causes for most of human history is rooted in mythology. It thunders because Zeus is angry. You're sick because God doesn't like you. Even today, we encounter the echoes of those ancient ideas: sickness as a moral failing, treatment as a rejection of divine will. And aside from the religious impulse, we also properly give weight to our own lived experiences. As a surgeon, I often told my patients, you know yourself best. Tell me what you're feeling. Tell me what feels wrong. And I meant it. Each of our experiences of our own bodies is a massive source of information. You know what normal and not normal feels like. We observe ourselves continually and discover real and important data. And yet, without anatomy, it's impossible to translate that experiential information into medicine. Today, a lot of us can attribute pain here to heartburn. We know that this means an esophagus and a stomach. Oftentimes, mom has diagnosed pain here as appendicitis before the kid comes to the emergency room. But these intuitive or seemingly intuitive insights reflect a cultural knowledge of anatomy. Why does the region under your ribs and above your pelvis ache every time you eat ice cream? Today, I can tell you it's because the brush border of your small intestine doesn't produce enough lactase, meaning that the milk you're ingesting is building up gas in the colon, activating your stretch receptors, causing flatulence, causing pain. Without anatomy, the same sensation can be equally explained by saying, God forbids the consumption of milk. Or he only lets priests consume it. Or maybe you can only consume it if you're a woman under 20 on opposite Tuesdays when the moon is full. Any of these explanations will get you to stop drinking milk, but only one of them leads to lactate and lactose-free ice cream. Anatomy in this way is the precondition to everything. It turns our bodies from a black box to a book we can read, a puzzle we can solve, a natural phenomenon we can observe and explain. Anatomy is an obvious precondition in surgery, where my ability, for example, to remove a tumor requires me to understand the blood supply of the nearby organs, the relationship of one tissue to another, the ways in which I can or can't reroute the intestines. But it's also a necessary precondition to physiology. Anatomy is the description of our parts. Physiology is the understanding of how they work. Before we can get immunology, oncology, virology, before there are pediatricians and oncologists and audiologists and infectious disease experts, we need the anatomists. As Osler put it, history is simply the biography of the mind of man. And our interest in history and its educational value to us is directly proportionate to the completeness of our study of the individuals through whom this mind has been manifest. If anatomy is the gateway that transforms our observations of the body into the science of medicine, then the history of anatomy is the story of the individuals who made this field possible. If we are to understand the immense value of this field to us and to our lives personally, we need to understand the stories of the individuals who gave it birth and gave it life. I think of the story of anatomy as a story with four acts. And today I'm going to walk through them in a schematic form. And in truth, there are more than just these four. There are names I'm horrified to be leaving out, like Paracelsus and Vesalius. And there are stories I can't believe I'm not going to have time to tell, like the anatomy murders of Burke and Hale. Ask in the Q&A, it's really good. But there's a specific story I want to tell today. And it is a story about the anatomists who shaped our lives through their work. So this is a story in four acts, starting here with Act One, the ancients. And a lot of these names are familiar to you. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, Aristotle, who contributed so much to science as well as philosophy, and Herophilus of Alexandria, who many call the father of anatomy. And there are less familiar names as well, like the surgeon Hua Tao in China, who created the earliest anatomical charts, or Sushruta, the famous Hindu physician, who almost certainly inspired Herophilus and, later, Galen. The earliest recorded attempts to detail facts about the inside of the human body came thousands of years ago. And they bring into sharp relief the tremendous practical challenges with pursuing this particular science. Especially, they highlight a crucial issue at the heart of the field. The fastest, most direct, most accurate way of advancing the knowledge of human anatomy is the dissection of human cadavers. History shows us there is no substitute to human dissection. When we've been able to dissect, we've been able to observe the facts and infer the causes of human health and human disease. The less we can do that, the more observation gives way to speculation. And the more we're forced to rely on comparative anatomy from animal dissections as the only access point to information. In the beginning, we relied heavily on comparative anatomy, and it was a start. Aristotle and Hippocrates, for example, based their anatomic conclusions exclusively on animal dissection. Inferring conclusions about human anatomy from animal study is a common strategy throughout history, and it is the source of most of our early knowledge. But as you might guess, the strategy has limitations as a sole source of information. While we share innumerable similarities with the rest of the animal kingdom, there are some important differences. Even the classic Valentine-shaped heart that we associate today is a schematic representation, not of a human heart, but of a pig's heart, which is most of what Hippocrates dissected. But unfortunately, human dissection has always been seen as suspicious at best, and usually as heretical. Take as another example the Hindu physician Sushruta, practicing around 500 BC in India, who consistently emphasized the importance of dissection. But Hindu laws, following a pattern repeated across cultures, forbade contact with the deceased, requiring rapid cremation. He was forbidden to dissect, by law and by custom, moral and legal decree. The bodies of the dead were burned, and to handle a corpse, much less dissect it, would have been sacrilege. With one exception, children under the age of around 2 or 3 are even to this day usually refused at crematoria throughout India, citing a tradition that such young corpses be, quote, submerged in a holy river. Sushruta created a number of anatomical texts in his lifetime, and he has powerful early insights. But he also makes some peculiar errors, especially about the nature of unformed long bones, unfused cranial sutures, or the mechanics of the joints. Why? Because he based his conclusions on the dissections of babies, which was the only cadaver available to him at the time. In relying on comparative inferences and loopholes, essentially, there are a number of strange conclusions from these early forays into anatomy. There was a prevailing belief, for example, that survived well into the 17th century, that female hysteria, which was a term that could be associated with everything from actual psychosis to a desire to avoid pregnancy, had its root in the wandering womb. Treatments ranged from hypnosis to blasting the abdomen with a jet of water. Hippocrates advocated for placing foul-smelling salts at the nose and sweet-smelling flowers at the vagina. In this theory, the womb is capable not only of independent motion, but also scent perception. Yeah. It seems absurd now, I hope. I guess ask in the Q&A if you're not sure about that one. But who could disprove it? For most of human history, dissection, any perceived violation of the human body after death, was a taboo, an affront to the gods and to human dignity. Many societies treated the dead body as a source of pollution, not to be handled. Others treated the dead body as sacred. In ancient China, for example, Confucianism held that the body must remain intact after death. It's actually still one major reason that organ donation is still very rare in China. For an artistic representation of this taboo in ancient Greece, think about the portrayal of the sanctity of the body in Antigone, where the main conflict is the struggle of a loving sister, not to preserve her brother's life, but to uphold the sanctity of his corpse. There's something that feels instinctively right, undeniably human, about protecting the body even after death. The body is the remains of a human being that was loved, that had dignity, and whose memory lives on. And it properly represents the person and warrants respect. And in the ancient world, the unblemished skin was a metaphor for the moral condition of the person who died. Cutting it open was to commit sacrilege, to destroy the integrity of the soul. So what kind of person, under such fear of censure, under the eyes of a disapproving society and a vengeful deity, would dare to explore the mysteries of our inner form? If the intact human body is a representation of the person who was, what is the moral status of those who would pick and prod at it and turn it into an object of study? For a moment, for a minute, in Alexandria, the ban was lifted. The Ptolemy family came to power in Hellenistic Egypt, creating a unique place in time, a place straddling between the Greek commitment to scientific advancements and the Egyptian death worship and willingness to manipulate corpses after death, if only for mummification. And for 40 years, bookended by centuries of prohibition on either side, human dissection was legal for scientific and medical research. Human anatomy was not just advanced by Herophilus in Alexandria during those 40 years. In a very real sense, it was born. His was the first description of the cranial nerves, the first demonstration of the valves of the heart, the first identification of a pulsing artery. And he pieced together a complete human skeleton, which was displayed at the Alexandrian Museum and Library for centuries afterwards. The significance of this skeleton is hard to imagine today. Elementary school science classrooms have skeletons on display. You can buy a high-quality replica on Amazon for less than $200 with next-day shipping. But for thousands of years before and after Herophilus, most scientists and physicians had never seen a human bone unless massive trauma caused one to protrude grotesquely through an injury. Herophilus and his meticulous, detailed observations were unique amongst the ancients, in part because he was the only ancient anatomist with unfettered access to human dissection. 40 years of legality amidst thousands of years of injunction. So this first part of the history of anatomy, the ancient anatomists, is a story of striving to learn, hemmed in by the limits of religious and cultural taboos, a relentless seeking to understand and to know despite limitations, a willingness to observe and assess whenever possible, and to draw inferences. The early anatomists pushed boundaries, including some that feel uncomfortable. They dissected babies. They cut open living animals. And these are things that feel to some of us instinctively wrong. But the seekers of knowledge found their way and did their work. And as a result, we started down the long road to modern medicine. This was the first step taken towards a scientific understanding of our bodies. And it was a step taken, quite literally, in defiance of man and God. This clash of science against law and religion continues throughout the history of anatomy. But there are other forces, too, that will emerge as limiting the anatomist's ability to observe and in to infer the causes of such observations. But we're leaving behind the ancients now and going to Act II, Claudius Galenus, or anglicized, Galen. It's the height of the Roman Empire. Rome has gained control of the entire Italian peninsula, the Western Mediterranean, and much of Spain. Roman culture is growing and expanding to keep pace with its military conquests, and all roads lead to Rome. And in 129 AD, Galen of Pergamon is born. Galen was still in the ancient world, but his outsized influence in his own life and beyond sets him apart from those who came before. He began studying medicine at age 15, returned home to Pergamon at age 20, and became a physician to the gladiators. Human dissection was again outlawed in the Roman Empire, and it's certain that his knowledge of surgery and anatomy was massively expanded by his opportunity to observe the gladiators' wounds. His meticulousness in all things earned him credit. While he held the post as physician to the gladiators, he lost only 5 patients. His predecessor lost 60 in a comparative time period. His success as physician to the gladiators eventually brought him to fame, and he moved to Rome and became court physician to Marcus Aurelius. His devotion to study, to observing and recording his observations, was unparalleled. He wrote more than 500 books in his lifetime, many of which have survived to this day, and said of his own dedication, "I don't know how it happened, miraculously or by divine inspiration or in a frenzy or whatever you may call it. But from my very youth, I despised the opinion of the multitude and longed for truth and knowledge." In fact, his medical colleagues were often startled by this so-called frenzy for studying the world, actually criticizing him for, quote, "pursuing truth beyond moderation." And indeed, his thirst for knowledge seemed unquenchable. He studied the works of other anatomists, including making a pilgrimage to Alexandria to see the skeleton. Like his predecessors, he did extensive animal dissections, including pigs, dogs, bears, monkeys, and apes. One contribution to comparative anatomy was an attempt to determine which animal was closest to human for each body part, an acknowledgement, at least, that not all knowledge can translate immediately from animal to human. For bones or reproductive organs, he relied on an ape. For the throat, he recommended dissecting a pig. In one famous experiment Galen frequently performed in public, he would take a living pig onto the stage and, while it was squealing, cut through either the vocal cords or the nerve that controlled them. The conclusion? The brain and its network of nerves supplies sound, not the veins and arteries, as was previously believed. His driving passion was an obsession with observation. He wrote extensively on anatomy, but he required his students to focus first on their own observations of animals, of gladiators, of the skeleton, and other exhibits in Alexandria. In addition to new discoveries about the body, he created several new methods for surgery and for dissection, and he required his students to read his books on methods rather than his many, many books on anatomy. In short, he taught his students how to observe rather than telling them what they should expect to see. He said, quote, "If anyone wishes to observe the works of nature, he should put his trust not in books of anatomy, but in his own eyes." Galen didn't have access to human dissection, at least not legally. And as we'll see, that led him to err in some of his conclusions. But his technical skill, precision, and commitment to detailed, extensive observation were unparalleled before or for hundreds of years after. Galen was a giant in the history of medicine because of both his work and his championing of observation. It's worth noting, however, that his greatness did not mean he was always right. Accurate observation is not a guarantee of complete truth. It doesn't automatically lead to correct inferences of causes. It doesn't even guarantee a proper method of inferences. In Galen's case, his observations on anatomy didn't carry over into his physiology. He continued to believe, as Hippocrates had advocated, that psychological or physical illness is caused by an imbalance in four bodily humors: black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. This theory of disease would remain dominant well into the 18th century, in large part because of Galen's advocacy. A predominance of black bile leads you to become melancholic. Pain occurs when one substance is present either in excess or in deficiency. The humoral theory of medicine is mostly devoted to either promoting or removing one of these four elements to get the body back into balance. As evidence of the impact, in 1799, George Washington became sick with what was probably pneumonia at Mount Vernon, and he was treated by the best physicians in the country. He tried bloodletting. They applied Spanish flies to his throat to cause blisters. They gave him ipecac and other things to make his vomit. And Washington took the treatment, and he thanked the doctors for their pains, which included removing about half his blood volume. It's impossible to know for sure if Washington could have survived without antibiotics, which were not yet invented, but it is certain that his chances were markedly reduced by the treatment provided. And like most Greeks, Galen was a strong proponent of the pneumatic theory. As with most early theories on how the world or the body works, this is religious in nature. Originally, it comes from a belief in three souls, or pneuma, proposed by Plato. Air, in this theory, is the divine breath of God. In writings from Plato and the Stoics, it's the breath of the god Zeus. Christian philosophers simply changed the moniker. When we inhale this air into our lungs, it creates the first pneuma. The arteries, which today we know carry blood, are actually named for the Greek arteria, meaning windpipe. They were supposed to carry the air soul to the gut, where it was transformed with each meal into a higher pneuma, or vital spirit. That was traveled back to the brain to create the highest form of pneuma, or animal spirit, which traveled through hollow nerves out to the rest of the body. So while Galen was fanatical about ruthlessly observing and recording the natural world, this commitment to truth didn't extend far enough to reject a physiological explanation rooted in mysticism. Looking back, it's actually easy to see where Galen's own observations should have led to the rejection of the pneumatic theory. He demonstrated that arteries carried blood, not air. His experiments on nerves, including his famous pig experiments, showed that they're not hollow, and in fact, a very different structure with a very different function than arteries and veins. But hindsight is 20/20, and the fact is that despite his great work on anatomy and in methods of observation, Galen did not question the humoral theory or the pneumatic theory, and in fact was a vocal proponent of both. Galen today is more often remembered for his mystical views on physiology, or pneumatology, or for his minor anatomic errors that are due in large part to his forced reliance on animal dissections. And it's valid to stress those errors, especially in light of what's about to happen in Act 3 of our drama. But Galen deserves to be remembered for what he was: a consummate physician, an experimental anatomist who, in his own words, emphasized observation above all, even though he was limited by the constraints of his society, and a father of anatomy who advanced the science in his own lifetime more than any scientist before him and any for centuries after. Galen's own view of the march of history and the advancement of any science, including his own, was that knowledge is cumulative. He built on the works of Aristotle and of Herophilus, observing independently through the lens of their ideas, and he expected his students and successors to build on his work. And perhaps that would have been the natural course. One of his students would have followed his example, studied his methods, made the trip to the great library at Alexandria, and seen with his own eyes, taking us, finally, to a place where anatomy and physiology meet. But something else happened instead. The Roman Empire fell, the church stepped in as the dominant power in Europe, and the culture was submerged into a dark age, where pursuit of knowledge essentially stopped for centuries. With no one left to pick up Galen's mantle, anatomy, along with most of the Western world, slept. And so we approach Act Three, the world after Galen. The world after Galen means a world in the Dark Ages, where knowledge that remains is preserved as though frozen in amber, intact, but ossified and no longer growing. So what happens when the world wakes up? In Europe, the Catholic Church banned human dissection from 200 AD until around the 1400s. Then, when the ban was lifted, dissection became legally possible, although only on the body of executed criminals. In 1493, Mondino de Luzzi, a professor at the University of Bologna, performed the first public human dissection in over a millennium and became known as the restorer of anatomy. In 40 brief years of legal dissection in the ancient world, Herophilus revolutionized the science. Even without legal dissection, Galen pushed anatomic understanding forward on all fronts. So it stands to reason that now, with a cultural renaissance, a revival of interest in science, medicine, and philosophy, and legal access to dissection, surely anatomic and medical knowledge must advance. But that's not what happens. First, it's simply not the case that freedom to study and research automatically results in new advances. Such freedom is necessary, but not sufficient. Advancement requires fresh acts of innovation and insight to actually materialize in new knowledge. And pushing against that innovation and insight is the church, which remains firmly interested in questions of science, including questions of anatomy. Remember the pneumatic theory, the idea that various types of spirits are carried in a one-way circuit through the arteries? The church has adapted this theory and used it to defend their firm belief that the heart is the seat of the soul. The iconography of the Sacred Heart is omnipresent in Catholicism. And when a saint dies, his heart would often be removed, embalmed, and put on display as a miracle-working relic. In the mid-1500s, a theologian named Michael Servetus published a treatise arguing that the soul of man resides in the bloodstream rather than the heart, as the church believes. He proposed an alternative theory on the flow of blood, advocating that scientists who wish to understand humanity should look to the blood. He was burnt at the stake as a heretic in 1553. And I want to pause on that for a second. This is a human being, the professor, an academic, tied to a post and set on fire because he posited an alternative account of the human body that challenged the religious sensibilities of the day. The church was a major obstacle to independent thought, but the problem extended beyond the church. It extended to the basic epistemological orientation of the time. Previously, anatomists had lacked the ability but not the will to observe. They strove to find connections between anything they could observe, animal or human, and the adult human form they sought to understand. There were major misconceptions about the way the body worked, but always a good faith effort to understand its component parts. 16th century Europe, by and large, does not take advantage of the opportunity to dissect and study the body's form and function. Medicine at this time is in the hands of doctors of physic, educated men who study in Greek and Latin, Arabic and Hebrew. They're part of an exclusive and powerful profession. They explain why the body malfunctions with reference to black or yellow bile. They perform bloodletting and prescribe remedies. And they're concerned with the body's function. These are learned and respected men. And by and large, they are quacks. And then there's a very different type of practitioner emerging across Europe. These are the barber surgeons. These useful and practical individuals take care of anything from a shave and a haircut to an amputation or an enema. They're a different class of person, not usually educated, unable to read the books of medicine or understand the lectures that are typically delivered in Latin or another ancient language. The societal standing of the barber surgeons can be inferred from the fact that before the Amsterdam Company of Surgeons was created in the late 1700s, they were included as something of an afterthought in the Guild of Clog and Skatemakers. This is a world divided between educated men who read the ancients but don't add to the science, and practical workers who do what needs to be done for a problem in front of them, be it a haircut, a broken bone, or a boil. And in this world where the study of medicine is divorced from the practice of treating a patient, Galen takes on a near mystical level of importance. As Europe begins to rediscover his work, Galenism becomes the dominant philosophy in medicine. While Galen himself emphasized the importance of first-handed observation, Galenists emphasize only the infallibility of his written work. In 1559, 1,000 years after Galen's death, a physician in London dared to report that he had found 22 errors in Galen's hundreds and hundreds of publications. The Royal College of Physicians forced him to retract his statement, declaring that it was unthinkable to question the accuracy of Galen. The noted anatomist Vesalius, a hero in his own right, whose story I'm not able to tell today, sought to explicitly challenge the cult of Galen, publishing beautifully rendered drawings of a human form side by side with that of an ape, tallying where the observations of Galen more closely reflected the animal than the man. Jacob Silvius, Vesalius's instructor and teacher, responded, "Then man must have changed his structure in the course of time, for the teachings of Galen cannot err." It was a challenging moment in anatomic history. Starting in the 1400s, dissection is permissible. And there are men, Da Vinci and Vesalius most notably, who push for an advancement of the science by means of direct observation. But overwhelmingly, anatomy and physiology are frozen in the era of Rome. For the ancients, including Galen, the challenge was practical, a lack of opportunity to explore the body. For the so-called Galenists of Renaissance Europe, it's not practical, but philosophic. A lack not of access or ability, but of a method that oriented them towards full intellectual independence. As one historian put it, in a familiar irony of history, as Galen's books became sacred texts, his own spirit of inquiry became forgotten. Don't worry, we're getting to Act Four. The story gets better. This brings us to William Harvey. We've covered the world before Galen, when anatomists were limited primarily by a lack of resources, and we've seen how far Galen's commitment to meticulous observations took him, despite those limitations. And we've seen the reverse, that even when limitations are lifted after the Dark Ages, there's an active closing of the mind, ironically in the name of Galen, that prevents science from advancing. And now it's 1616. It's only about 50 years after Michael Servetus was burned at the stake for advancing his theories on the circulation of the blood. The world is still torn between science and faith, between the ability to observe and infer, and the cultural blinders of both the church and of Galen. Criticism of one is punishable by death. Criticism of the other warrants rejection from medical society and ostracization from the learned men of the time. And against this historical and cultural backdrop, a man named William Harvey stands on the podium of the Royal College of Physicians in London. He's there to deliver the second annual Lumleian Lecture on Anatomy. It's a considerable honor for somebody who is still only a junior fellow at the college. He's a small, dark man with penetrating eyes, a quick, vivacious manner, and an ease on the stage that reveals no anxiety either about the luminaries in front of him or the heretical topic he's about to discuss. The hall is packed with onlookers. Not just the doctor's physic, but the lay public and the barber surgeons. Why are they here? Well, for one thing, there are rumors about this lecturer and his lecture. that he has strange views and stranger methods. For another, it's been announced that he plans to lecture in English, a language that everyone in the audience understands, but a stark departure from the tradition at the time to lecture in Latin. Harvey's talk lasts the entire day, including references to over 100 authors from Aristotle to Fabricius. The topic of his lecture? His observations on the circulation of the blood. And you can picture it, the packed hall with hushed onlookers, the bearded luminaries in the front from the university, the blood-stained barber surgeons and aprons in the back, the gawkers and the public and everybody in between. And picture 37-year-old Harvey there on stage, presenting a lecture in plain common speech that contradicts both Galen and the church. He has spent the last 2 decades in meticulous dissection of both animals and people. He has unapologetically embraced vivisection of animals, dissection of living creatures in a pre-anesthesia era to understand the action of the body in anima. And he has concluded something revolutionary. The blood, he says, does not regenerate in the gut with every meal. The blood recirculates with each beat of the heart. During the course of his full-day lecture, he doesn't simply describe his discoveries. He brings cadavers, patients, living animals onto stage and demonstrates each of his observations directly. In a move reminiscent of Galen, he brings a live pig onto the stage. Everybody's always cutting pigs up. He slashes its neck while still alive, cutting first through the internal jugular, revealing a steady spray of dark red blood, and then through the carotid artery, spraying the stage and probably several professors in the front row with a stream of crimson. Arteries and veins, he says, are fundamentally different. The blood that flows through them is fundamentally different. But he doesn't stop there. He brings a strong man onto stage, with muscular arms and large prominent veins. He places a tourniquet around his forearm, causing the veins to distend or pop out. So why does this happen? This doesn't sound strange to any of us, because most of us have either given blood or had blood taken for medical purposes. We know the process of putting a tourniquet so that the nurse can find your veins more easily. But why does this happen? Now remember, the pneumatic theory argues that blood flows in a one-way circuit, away from the heart and towards the limb. Blood flows into the hand, but not back to the heart in this theory. If this is true, picture what it should look like when you tie the tourniquet. Think of the cartoon where a man steps on a garden hose, blocking the flow. If the flow happens in one direction, the way water flows through a hose, when you block the flow, the distension occurs only proximal or before the level of obstruction. In this theory, the pneumatic theory, the flow of blood is like the flow of water through a garden hose. Imagine your reaction if this man steps on the hose and the hose distends here. Something is fundamentally wrong about your understanding of garden hoses. And you can try this experiment at home. It's easier if you're a bodybuilder with big arms, but this works for anyone. A tourniquet applied just above the elbow will result in veins popping out in the forearm. Can you hear the murmurs in the crowd? This is sacrilege. The teachings of Galen cannot err, but it's right there in front of them, available for anyone who wants to look. Because Harvey had the courage to see, and because he trusted his mind in defiance of man and of God. Next, Harvey points to the veins and he says, see, they're not uniform. There are places where the veins pop out and places where they're smaller. These areas where they pop out, he argues, are the valves, the one-way valves in the vein that control the flow. Now, he's not the first one to describe valves and veins. Hippocrates had that honor. But Galen and most of those that followed argued that the valves controlled the rate at which pneuma was delivered to the body. Harvey doesn't assume you'll agree with him that these are valves. He brings a cadaver on stage and dissects out the veins, showing how they correspond to the bulges on the man's forearm. And then he begins to press down on the veins, essentially milking the blood towards the hand, away from the heart, past a one-way valve controlling flow. Again, pneumatic theory holds that blood can flow in only one direction. It goes from the heart towards the hand. He milks the blood towards the hand past the valve, compressing it with his finger. And as he releases his finger on stage, it immediately pops back up, filled with a rush of blood returning from the hand towards the direction of the heart. As the editor of his eventual first English edition put it, "Truly a bold man indeed, O disturber of the quiet of physicians, who first of all durst oppose an opinion confirmed for so many ages by the consent of all." It took Harvey another 10 years to publish his theories in writing, in part due to the aggressive response of the community. Physicians, philosophers, and theologians all had a reason to violently disagree with Harvey's theory. It threatened the prevailing views on the nature of humanity and the source of truth in medicine. Before 1616, Harvey was a respected member of the medical elite, on his way to a powerful career, physician to royalty, invited to give luminous talks at major universities. After the lecture, and especially after the publication of his books, he became essentially a non-entity in medical and political circles. At one point, the British Parliament actually sent soldiers to his home to confiscate his research. But Harvey had an advantage Galen didn't have: students who followed in his immediate footsteps. He fought through decades of misunderstanding, political persecution, and professional rivalry. But unlike so many of the moral and intellectual giants of human history, Harvey was vindicated in his own lifetime. In 1654, at the age of 76, the man who dared challenge the authority of his day was elected president of the London College of Physicians. There were countless anatomic discoveries still to make after 1616, and some of them were made by Harvey himself or his students or the new schools that were popping up throughout Europe and in the United States and eventually the globe. Today, the advancements in anatomy are largely facilitated by technology, lenses, lights, and rays that enable us to see more than ever before with less and less invasive techniques. In many cases, we no longer need to open up the body to see what's inside. But Harvey was one of those who took the first steps, who observed when it was practically challenging and morally demanding to do so, who observed a part of the world hidden by both physical and philosophical restraints, who defied the censure of his profession, the condemnation of his society, and the judgment of his deity, and who had the temerity to draw conclusions based on the evidence of his own eyes, and in so doing, who changed our understanding of ourselves. It is to anatomy that we owe the discipline of medicine and the causal understanding of the body that it represents. And it is to observation that we owe anatomy. Observation of the inner workings of the body, like observation of the celestial bodies or the deepest recesses of the seas, is challenging. For most of history, access has been the biggest deterrent to truth. But having the ability to observe, access to a telescope, a periscope, or a dissecting table, is not a guarantee of pursuit of truth or acceptance of new ideas. No human value is automatic. No advance results merely from setting the conditions. Individual human beings, armed with the ability and the courage, have to make the most of the opportunity afforded. So it is to anatomy that we owe medicine, and it is to observation that we owe anatomy. But it is to men like Herophilus, Galen, and William Harvey that we owe the observations. As Osler put it, "In departing from any settled opinion or belief, the variation, the change, the break with custom may come gradually. and the way is usually prepared. But the final break is made, as a rule, by some one individual, the masterless man of Kipling's splendid allegory, who sees with his own eyes and with an instinct or genius for truth, escapes from the routines in which his fellows live. But he often pays dearly for his boldness. So this is my love story for anatomy and for observation, and above all, for the masterless man. Thanks, guys. Thank you. I have no idea how much time I have for questions. I have 10 minutes for questions. Thank you so much. Ooh, good question. I was actually just talking about this, and I don't know in great detail, but I will say that a lot of what we've preserved of Galen's writings came to us through Arabic physicians. So a lot of the work of pre-Dark Ages Europe was translated into Arabic by Muslim scholars, and that's why it sort of survived into the Renaissance. There were certainly advances made, although I don't know the specifics, but I will say one interesting fact about that. There were several Arabic physicians who argued over laying claim to the title Galen of Islam. So the Galenism of Renaissance Europe was present first in the Middle East. Ooh, yeah, that's a really good story, but I feel like we might not have time. I will tell you later, and then next year. We didn't even get to the dark side. Oh my gosh, please.
And talk to her about some findings that we have with DMT, with fungi. And I'm not talking about like hallucinogenics or drugs that are artificial, but the findings of what the human brain is capable with these substances that are part of our DNA and that are part of nature. And in the name of observation, I would like to know your opinion as a medical doctor and as a historian that knows how, without observation of what reality is throwing at us, what can we say about DMT or fungi or even CBD and THC as keys, natural keys that are bringing health, not only physical health to patients with cancer, but also psychological health, depression, PTSD, yeah. Addictions, yep. Etc. Thank you.
Yeah, really interesting question. You know, there's a couple things. One is I wouldn't make any distinction between the natural and the lab-made for the sort of essence of the answer. I don't think there is one. Neuroscience and psychology is the next frontier. You know, I talk about how difficult it was to peel back the physical barrier to look inside the body, and we've overcome that barrier now. It's even harder to figure out how to observe when the observations are so internal, you know, and functional MRI and these things give us sort of a window to sort of make inferences about what's happening, but we are in our infancy of neuroscience. And so I'm fascinated by the potential. I'm not recommending that anybody go out and do hallucinogens and saying it's under doctor's orders after this lecture, but I'm fascinated by the potential and really excited by the research that's coming out. I think it's the next frontier, you know, in terms of the specific strategies we'll need to observe those outcomes. I don't know that I can even begin to say, but I'm really excited to see what happens next. I do think it's a really exciting place where science is pushing forward. And
question
I think I'm getting
online.
Waved down by online.
Can you give us any recommendations for movies, TV shows, books about the anatomists?
Good question. I will be totally honest and self-serving and say that one of the reasons I initially proposed this talk is because it's long been sort of a point of pain with me that there is no good book on William Harvey. There's two biographies of him that I know of, and they're dry as dust, and his was such an exciting life. And so I wish there was a better book. I really like, you know, it's not the whole book, but there's a book by Daniel Borstein, the historian I quoted, called The Discoverers, and there's only like one section on anatomy, but the whole book is dedicated to the idea of those people in times that just advanced our understanding of the world, of daring to look everywhere and what that observation and inference took. So that's one I really love. There's lots on the history of surgery that I could recommend. There's a great movie and book, I think it's called The King of Hearts, on the early days of heart surgery, which is also super dramatic. That's what comes to the top of my head.
You showed a quote about how you could throw the entire corpus
Materia
of
Medica.
Yeah, into the sea, and it would be the better for humankind and worse for fishes.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you have any theory or understanding of how was the knowledge of the body and the knowledge of medicine somehow incrementally moving forward, and yet the practice was so detrimental to humans. Like, it seems kind of backwards or opposite.
For a while, it's really the fact that anatomy and physiology were divorced. There was a divide between form and function, between mind and body. When you look at these theories, they don't make any anatomic sense. Like, Galen actually rejected the wandering womb theory because he dissected and he was like, guys, there's a lot of ligaments that secure this thing to the pelvis. He didn't actually reject female hysteria. He just thought it had other causes. But in a lot of ways, you know, trying to explain the cause of anything predated the observations that you needed to explain it, right? Like, you didn't wait until you had an understanding of meteorology to explain thunder and wind and rain and weather changes. You had to come up with these explanations. And then I think sometimes the observations were backfilled into them. So the humeral theory or the pneumatic theory all came way earlier than the observations you needed to prove or disprove them, or to some extent even to suggest them, right? Like, the pneumatic theory is all about how we think, you know, it's like intuited observations of our own bodily functions and belief about God and sort of things that get mishmashed together. And the problem is then when you gain observations, rather than using them to first-handedly create a theory, you're using them to backfill and you're saying, well, now I see there are valves in the veins. How could valves help pneuma travel to the arms? I see, they control the flow of pneuma. And so it's having the theory before the facts, I think, was a limitation. And one of the reasons why it was such a dramatic leap forward to have someone like Harvey, who didn't just tally the observational errors in Galen, but used that tally of observational errors, or just his first-handed observations, to change the conclusions, to really finally marry anatomy with physiology.
I'm a bit stressed, so I'm hopeful that I'll manage to express the question. So the objective of medicine is health, right? And today we are able to solve so many problems that cavemen could not solve, like broken bones, severed limbs, infections, all of these we solve quite efficiently. But what about heart problems, sleep apnea, dental problems, chronic back pain,
gosh,
depression, allergies, migraines, diabetes, erectile
dysfunction.
He doesn't
ask much, does he? One-hour lecture.
So all of these problems are like problems that barely existed before. Like, these are problems of the modern world, and I'm asking, is anatomy the way to solve these modern problems, or could it be that there is something else?
Well, anatomy is the start, right? So yes, we have not solved all health problems, and some health problems are diseases of affluence. Wasn't a lot of cancer in prehistoric times. Prehistoric man would have loved to survive to die of cancer. Today, we would like to survive farther. You know, so it's as we advance, we develop new problems.
Can I challenge that for a second? Because there are modern hunter-gatherers tribes that have people living to their 70s and 80s without cancer and without back pain and without all of these modern problems. So maybe the paradigm of thinking only through anatomy is one of the causes for these problems. Because I believe that anatomy, to the question of health, is quite similar to the study of economics to the question of politics, right? Because like economics would not bring people to accept laissez-faire as the way. So maybe the study of anatomy isn't the tool for the question of what's healthy.
Well, anatomy is necessary but not sufficient, right? It's not as though once you understand the parts of the human body, and as you understand more, you raise more questions, right? Macroanatomy gives way to microanatomy, gives way to questions of physiology, gives way to a more complex discussion of pharmacology. I guess it depends what you're asking. If you're asking, do I think we would be better off if we abandoned this knowledge and went back to a hunter-gatherer society, my answer would be no, I like civilization. If the answer is anatomy sufficient to solve all questions of health? No. But I do think it's a necessary precondition.
Thank you.
All right. And then that was my time. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.